topic tonight, I want to talk about bris, because the end of the parasha is bris milah. I want to talk one or two points about bris, and then I want to talk about, in general, the concept of shmiras of bris, with some thoughts about it, which I think a little bit of an angle which is usually not usually approached from that angle. So first I want to tell you, there's a piece over here from the Vilna Gaon, where he explains the concept of, we talk about a bris, what exactly is a bris? And the more the Torah uses the lashon of krisis bris as a regular usage. I have to share some copies. The regular usage is krisis bris, that they're being kares bris. The brach is kares bris, to cut a bris. What do you mean you cut a bris? What are you cutting? Right? Okay. So if you look at the note on the bottom, so he wants to explain. He brings from the Sefer Yetzirah. So there was a nichras bris. So Sefer Yetzirah, the Vilna Gaon. This is a quote from the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon wrote a pirish on Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is a fascinating collection of brises which talk about very Kabbalistic concepts. Let's just leave it like that. Sarva l'chomau inyan bris. I'm going to explain to you what a bris is. What's the idea of a bris? They have two friends which love each other like themselves. They really would like that they should never part. But that's not possible. They have to part. They have to go different ways. But they have this tremendous feeling of they want to stay together. So what do they do to like hold on to that feeling? So I take the most precious thing that I have and I give it to that person. When I do that, every time I think about the thing, I think about the person. And every time he thinks about, and he does the same thing for me. So we're constantly having that other person in our thoughts, because what's the most precious thing that we have, we've given away to them. So that's what the day of that's how we're kares bris. Okay, they are bound together by that item. Even though they separate, so let's take Reuben and Shimon. So Reuben gives his most precious thing to Shimon. Shimon leaves. Shimon takes the item with him. So Reuben's always going to think about Shimon because Shimon has my favorite whatever. Okay. The bris is that through this item, we're never going to part. So that's what the word bris means. What is the idea of krisis bris? The cutting of the bris, the cutting of the covenant. I take something which is really bound to me. I cut it out of me and I give it to that other person. Take the thing which is most precious to me, which means it's intrinsic to me, it's part of me, and I give that away to the other person. So whenever I think about that, I think about the other person. Okay. So he then talks about how the keshes was a bris. I'm not getting involved in that right now, but the bottom line is v'chena tarva milo hey dorma hey soy ben ibori yisbrach ben yisrael. Okay, so the brush must carry bris with the milah. So we'll see later on that the first says that when we think about the bris milah, the Torah refers to it as a bris milah, the Torah refers to it as an ois bris. Now, the bris is the covenant itself. The ois bris is that which represents the covenant. So we need to figure out, when we talk about the mice of Milo, which one is it? The answer is it's both. It has elements of bris in it. This is the covenant. And it has elements of the ois bris. So, according to the Vilna Gaon is saying, the Milo is the ois of the bris which we made. So we have to figure out, what did we give to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and what did he give to us? So we have the most dear thing which we have, we gave to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the Russian gave the most dear thing to him, to us. So what is that? So we have an easy, our side is easy. We've committed to the Torah, we've committed to this relationship to the point that we're willing to give our lives, if necessary. That is our commitment. We've given over to Kodesh Baruch Hu's hands, as it were, the most precious thing that we have, which is our life. What about Kadosh Baruch Hu's side? What is the most precious thing to him that he gave away to Klal Yisrael through the Krisis Bris? So the Rosh Hashanah created the world because he wants to benefit mankind. He wants to give to the world. His greatest desire is to give. The Rosh Hashanah is I'm saying it tongue in cheek a little bit, but he's a quintessential Jewish mother. Right? He wants to give. In the Kabbalah, the name for the Shekhinah is Ima. It's Mama. And the Bali Machshava, the Chassidish of Bali Machshava, they used to refer to the Kadosh Baruch Hu as Mama. The Mama Mir Geshikta means the Shekhinah sent me to this world. Mama Mir Geshikta. The Shekhinah would send us to this world. The Jewish mother is one who her whole desire is to give. The Russian desire is to give. Now, the Russian decided like this, which we have to train our Jewish mother sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. That it's not always good to give. Because a child just gets and gets and gets, becomes spoiled and smothered. It's not good for the child. So what do we say? You're only going to get if you deserve it. So how does a Jewish mother feel about that? She knows it's the best thing for the child, but it's really painful for her because she wants to give. That's what the Russian gives to Klal Yisrael. He would like to give to the world and just give and give and give and give. But instead he put over the control of the world, whether we get or not, in our hands. So if we're good, we get. We're not good, we don't get. When we don't get, the Russian is in pain. Because his most desired thing that he has in the world is to give to us. But he said, I'm not going to give because I gave that over to you. I put that in the control of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael, through their actions, now decide what the world's going to get. And if we're not good, the world doesn't get. And the merchant says, I'm so happy. He says, I'm in such pain. But I gave it over the precious thing. So the Krisis Bris was the moment when Avraham Avinu became the one who's in charge of the world. Avraham Avinu and that his descendants became the ones who are in charge of the world. That's the bris that the Russian made on his part. That's the bris on the Russian side. And our side is we committed our lives. Now, why is the mila the ois of that bris? We're not explaining right now why the mila is the ois of that bris. And we'll have to explain why the mila would be a very good way to represent that commitment between the two sides. But that's how the Gaon learns. Okay. The next few pieces are from Rav Hirsch. So I apologize for those of you who had difficulty with Rav Hirsch's English and have to would prefer the Hebrew. They say a joke about, there was a person who went to hear this German speak. So the fellow gets up, like after 50 minutes, he's ready to leave. The guy says, you can't leave before the verb. the sentences are like, that's how they, and finally you get the idea what it's about. Like at the end, like after like this whole paragraph. So he writes like that. But there's a certain beauty to it. I happen to love it, the language. Okay. So the parasha of Bris is introduced with two thoughts. The Russian says to Avraham Avinu, I'm Kel Shakai. He's Halecha Fanai Vayesomi. So there's a point over here of that the name of a Kadosh Baruch, which is used to introduce the Bris, is Shakai. Shin, Dalad, and then a Yud. So why is that the name of a Kadosh Baruch, which is the right name to introduce? It's not used beforehand. We have Hashem, we have Elohim, we have Kael, right? This is a new name. So why is that the name which is going to be used to introduce it? And then Bereshit says to Avraham Avinu, he's Alech Lefanai Bayes Tomim. I want you to walk in front of me and be Tomim. And then that's going to be expressed through the Bris Milah. So we need to explain both of those points. Okay. So Chazal say that what is the name Shakai, the Shin Dalad Yud, what represent? So if you look at towards the bottom of the first page of the I guess it's page 291, right? It says Chazal bring the Bereishis Rabba, Ani Shemarti L'Olam Idai, I'm the one who said to the world sufficient, die, it's enough. Shemala Shemarti L'Shemayim Ba'aretz die. If I would not have told the world, die, it's enough. They would continue to expand, they would keep going. Okay? Dayecha shani patronka v'lo lekav levatcha el dayer l'olam shani lekav shani patron. So the Brishon says that the name Shakai has in it 2 points. That one is, I put limits on the world, number one, and if I had not done so, the world would keep expanding. And number two, that the world is not enough, as it were. I'm enough, means I'm, as it were, bigger or better than what the world is. I'm greater than the world. Okay, so he focuses on, in this point over here, he focuses on the idea of the Brishon put limits on the world. So I got the right page now. I left that. Oh, I think I wanted to put more of that page in. I didn't. Okay. Skip the next 2 pages for now. Okay.
What does it mean?
I'm going to talk about it. Okay. So, a fascinating thing. One of the very basic thoughts which is used in Machshava in the of Chazal in Torah, Maral and others, is a concept called Chomer and Tzura. Chomer is the building blocks, it's the materials, and Tzura is the form that it takes. So that sounds very so, but let's explain what it means. We don't mean physical form, we mean a function. The word Tzura really means a function. In historical philosophical thought, things were made to fit their function. You figure out what their function was by seeing how they, what they did. That was their, became their purpose. So the standard motion you use is, okay, I take clay and I build a brick. So in the first step, the clay is the material, and the purpose is to make a brick. Okay, now I take the bricks and I build a wall. So in that situation, the brick is the chaimer, is the material, and the wall is the purpose. Now I build four walls and I put a roof on top. So in that situation, the walls are the material, they're the chaimer, and out of that I create. Now I move into the house and I dwell in it. The house is the material, it's the chaimer, and the tzura is, it becomes a function, that it becomes a home. Right? So we can move step after step after step. The way you define the tzura of something is by putting a limit on it. As long as it has no limits, we can't define what its function is, because it can do anything. The mashal which I give, I think I told you the story. So I had this fellow who came to visit Tells one time, and so Tells, this is my little concerns. Rashid Rapes once wrote a paper about this, a mimer about this. Like, is insulation better, or is exposure better? And he wrote that there's advantages to each one of them. But while the guy was in yeshiva, the approach of Hell's yeshiva was very much insulation. It was on campus. In my days, there was no off Shabbos during the winter. So you'd come, Sukkot, you'd leave Pesach. 6 month winter, 6 month winter. And you could be on campus for 6 months. There was a canteen on campus. There was a haberdashery, which they sold gloves, scarves, hats, paper, pen, whatever you needed, basically. There was a cleaner service, the dry cleaner service. You would drop, they would pick up the stuff on Monday and bring it back on Thursday night, and you. There was a laundromat in the dorm. There was a mikvah in the dorm. There was a barber shop in the dorm. There was a doctor which came once a week. There was a dentist which came once a week. You do not need to leave campus. Right. So the yeshiva was really built in such a way that really you could stay there and really just focus on your learning. So this fellow comes for a visit, secular guy, and I convinced him to come for a visit. He was from out of town. And I said, next time you're in Cleveland, like, stop by. So he stops by, goes to, they had classes for not, on Sunday morning, they used to have a program for people which weren't from. So after the class, I asked him, so what do you think? He says, Rabbi, you know, you live in a box. And you interface with the world from your box. He didn't mean it as a compliment. So I said to him, you know what? What I'm hearing from you is that you're of the opinion that limits are bad. So I'm going to prove to you that you don't really believe that. That's what I said. I said, I'm going to prove to you that you don't believe that. Okay? It says, your child now goes to college, and he's a very smart guy, but he really has difficulty making up his mind. So he wants to keep all his options open. Right? So he takes some science courses this way, you know, can go into one of the sciences. You know, the physical sciences. Then he takes some biology courses, and he wants to go that direction, you know, biology, the doctor. Takes some things about political science and law, because maybe he wants to become a lawyer. He takes some, you know, humanities things, and maybe he wants to become an English professor. So he's taking like 17 courses. Right, you know? After a year, he says, you know, this is ridiculous, I gotta make a decision. He says, you know what, I'm gonna become an architect. So he drops all the biology classes because he's not really using biology classes or an architecture. And the law classes also probably not so important. You know, the humanities, you know, he's done with that also. He focuses on the physical sciences, engineering, etc., and he becomes an architect. Is that a happy day or a sad day? So I asked the guy. He says, he hesitated for a minute, he says, I guess it's a happy day. So why is it a happy day? As far as I know, the percentages of architects who eventually become lawyers or doctors are very small. It's like less than 1%. So he put limits on the rest of his life. He never become a doctor or a lawyer or an English professor. He's only been an architect. It's such a sad day. He has limits. He says, no, well, now he can focus on what he wants to become and really become something. He says, so limits are good. Because limits create a function. If you have no limits, you have no function. When you put limits, you have a direction. Now you can do something. So when the Russian put dye on the world, he put limits on the world, that's when the world became, it took shape. As long as it's going to keep going, it has no shape. All this is just materials. So the challenge our society has is, like, you know, limits are treif. You know, boundaries in relationships are what make the relationship valid. I focus on one individual, so now I have a real relationship with them. I focus on many, I have no relationship with anybody. So we miss that point. So the version comes with the name Shakai. He's saying that the way you're going to become the person who's going to run the world, you're becoming now the people who are running the world. That's what the Vilna Gaon is saying. I've given to you the most precious thing that I have in the world. Whether the world has good or has bad, whatever's going to happen in the world is up to you now. If you act good, yes. If you act bad, no. I hate it. I mean, yeah. I really prefer to give. But I know the best thing for you and for the world is that that's not so. Therefore, I'm going to give up that to you and let you decide. So how am I going to do that? I says, because you have to understand that you now are the one who's responsible for the world. You have to understand the function and the purpose of the world. So the name of Shakai is the name which represents that the world has a function and has a purpose, because it has limits. So I'm going to give you an ois bris of a limit. Now, but why specifically this point of limitation is what I want to get to the next step. But you understand the thought process. The ois bris represents the idea that there is a part of the being which is limited. Right? You can certainly eat as much as you want. The body doesn't... We don't have a sign in our mouths not to eat too much. But we have a sign on one part of our body not to overindulge in this area. So this area is, we're putting limits. And that creates, once we put a limit, we now have an idea of that there's going to be a greater purpose and a greater function, which we couldn't get till we got the idea of limits. We haven't explained what yet, but we're moving towards that concept. Okay. Well, let's see what the verse says about the word tamim. He says, "Lech lefanei v'yes tamim." So the meal is going to make us tamim. This is from Rehearse's Collected Writings, Volume 3. So he wants to point the following thing. So I'm on page, I guess, it looks like 68. That's the left column on the first page of the Collected Writings. Second paragraph. So he points out this noteworthy peculiarity of the Hebrew language. It uses the same word in one in the same form to express the idea of ceasing to exist and completion, which is wholeness and perfection. For example, the word kalei, kala abai is the chol devarav, the house is completed, and kalei onon vayelik, the house, the cloud had vanished and was gone. So the word kalei means to end. It also means to complete, and in the sense of being destroyed or get rid of. So that's a very interesting point. So the word tamim is the same thing. In most verbal forms, it designates a complete cessation of existence. Tama vanecha, yitama katoyim, right? Tama kesef. The katoyim will end. There'll be no more katoyim. There'll be no more veira. There'll be no more money. It also means perfection. Ish tam set tamim paraduma tamima. So we use the word tamim to be perfect and to be ending. We use the word kalei in a similar way, ending and perfection. So what's that about? So you might say this concept, my next paragraph, might be based on the dual truth. On the one hand, that which is truly perfect can only be one thing. So anything that is truly perfect, truly one, has to cease to exist as anything else. So here we have this. If you really want to become what you are, you have to be not something else. So there's the moment of perfection. The Renaissance man really is the jack of all trades and master of none. Now the reason why he doesn't look like that is because compared to everybody around him, he's pretty good at all of them. But vis-a-vis what he could be, spending his abilities in 17 different areas means he's not reaching the perfection in any one of them. To reach perfection in any one of them means he has to give up some of the other ones. Right? Okay. Then, furthermore, upon next paragraph, but thinking about it more, in terms of the root tamem is to indicate a state in which all of the parts of an object, or the object in all of its parts, point to one direction only. So he wants to say the word tam means it gives it a partial direction also. So you hear where we're going over here. He selects of an object. Yes, tamem is the idea of ceasing to exist in a certain way. Means certain areas you're not going to put your interest in. You're going to put your focus on a certain thing, and that is completion and wholeness. By giving something up, you're coming complete. Okay, that's the thing. It's enough for that. Okay. This is from A Beautiful Sefer called Pathways to Personal Growth, and he deals with the idea what's referred to in the world of Torah, the Machshava of Kol Yisrael, Shmiras HaBris, that they're a person being careful of how he uses his organs of procreation. That a person doesn't waste his zera, person is only in context of a marriage, etc. So our society it challenges us with that. Okay? So it's a lot of, I put a lot of pages in. So I want to actually go first to page, which is at the end of the packet, pages 32, 33. And then we'll work backwards. So he presents over here, he wants to explain, we're familiar with Chabad. Chabad, pages 32 and 33, that's all the way at the end of the booklet. So, Chabad. Chabad stands for Chochma, Bina, and Das. The three levels of knowledge. So, what are these three levels of knowledge? So, it represents, in Shemaim, represents what's called Tziras. I'm not going to involve that part of it for now. Chochma is information, called knowledge, book knowledge. I open the book, I read the book, and I have information. Right? Bina is from the word binyan, to build. When I have a piece of information, which I understand that a piece of information, I understand the to its root, why it's so, I can extrapolate. I can apply it to other areas. So I tell you the following story. I think I told this story once, but it's a good story anyway. I'll do it again. This story, when the Rabbi Yechiel Spiro was doing his interviews for the a sefer on their gifter, so he interviewed me. I told him a story. He says, "Ellie, you know I can't put that story in the book." I said, "Yeah, but it's a great story." Okay, you're getting the story now. Okay, you'll see why you can't put it in the book. And then I says, "Okay, you owe me at least one. You owe me something. Tell me another story that you got from somebody else that you didn't put in the book." So he gave me that too. So in the city of Tells, there was a priest who had come to America, to Chicago, for a period of time and learned English. and then went back to tell Lithuanian. Remember the story? It's a good story, right? And so he had learned English. It tells this little... First, the city of Tells was about 10,000 people. It was the whole city. That was the whole city. And that's sort of, I mean, Kovno was like, was the capital, was 90,000 people. Like, you get an idea of the size of these cities, you know. So, what?
What country was that?
Lithuania. Lithuania. Kaunas, so you know, the Lithuanian name. So... there was very few people who spoke English in the city of Telz. So who spoke English in the city of Telz? There were three or four bachurim in the yeshiva who spoke English. So the yeshiva said that the yeshivas encouraged them to take walks lunchtime. They should, you know, they shouldn't get, you know, sit too long, etc. They should get out and get some exercise, etc. So the bachurim used to take walks lunchtime, and they would talk and learning. They would, you know, discuss whatever, you know. So it says this priest, this galach. That's the Yiddish word for a priest, right? Because they would shave their heads, the galochim. His galach means to shave. They were shaven heads. That was what they called galochim. So would wait. So he knew the route we used to take. He would wait, to, you know, and he would engage us in conversation. So Rashiva developed a relationship with this priest. So he borrowed a science book from the priest. You know, he was reading the science book. So a little while later, he's walking with his Rosh Hashiva, Rav Mitzvah Bloch, Hashem Yikim Domoy, and he tells him that he's reading the science book. So the Rosh Hashiva, Rav Bloch, says to Rav Gifter, who was a Bacher then, so tell me something interesting that you read. So he's discussed something about gravity, you know, he's reading something about the what type of force it is, etc. So the tells Rosh Hashiva, told Rav Gifter, says, imagine that, you know, whether the story is true or not, apocryphal or not, Newton had made the following observation. Objects fall. 100% true, right? You ever see objects not fall? They don't go up, they go down, right? 100% not true observation. Would he made it in the history books? No. Because the kunst is not to see what's there, the kunst is to understand why. Once you understand why objects fall, you understand the properties of gravity, you can predict the motion of the heavenly bodies. Let's say there's something wrong with the orbit of Saturn, there must be another planet out there. So you can go from watching an apple fall to finding the planet a planet. Because you understand why. He says, okay, let's say a person learns Yeridaya. Let's say, for argument's sake, there are 10,000 halachas in Yeridaya. And he memorizes all 10,000 halachas. He says, Talmud Chacham, right? He says, no, he's an Amoritz, because there's 100,000 possible shailas. So how do you pass in that case? It's not in the Shulchan Aruch. If you understand why that's the decision, you can pass in a million shailas. So the main thing is not to understand the what, but understand the why. So Chachma is the what. Bina is the why. I understand why it's so. I'm maven it, which we call the person is a maven. He understands. And then I can build on it. That's why it's called Bina. I can extrapolate. I can build out. Right? So the next step is Bina. So now what's Das? So that's pretty good, right? I understand the what, I understand the why. I got it all. So what's Das? Das is when I incorporate it into my own reality. So he gives a mashal over here to explain Das. It's on the page 32. So we refer to a boy who turns to a mitzvah. This whole book is written as a series of letters from an older bacher to a bar mitzvah boy. Understanding what happens at a bar mitzvah. What is a bar mitzvah about? So we refer to what's between a boy who's under the age of 13 and a boy who's at the age of 13. He's called a bar das. And a person who's a bar das is chayav a mitzvah. So what happens at the age of 13 is you become a bar das. Means now you have this ability of das. Till now you had chokhmah and you had bina, you're very smart kids, right? But das you don't have. Vilna Gaon was not a bar das till he was 13 years old. Vilna Gaon finished most of shas right before that, but that doesn't make a difference. But he's not a bar das. So what do you get at 13 when you didn't have beforehand? Okay. So on a deeper level, it's the third paragraph. The word das. Explains the union of the knower with the known. It's a connection between the me and the knowledge. There are two ways to know someone. You can be acquainted with him superficially. You know your neighbor down the block. You can also have a deep personal bond with someone. The way close friends know one another. That is analogous called das. You become bound with that which you're. I know you, and therefore to the point that I become connected to you. So he gives an example. I'm not going to read the example inside, but like this. Have you ever read Melville? Who read Melville?
Moby Dick,
right? Have you read it in the original, right? You ever read it in the Bridge version? The Bridge version is much better than the original, right? In some ways, it's much quicker, right? Melville loved describing things. You know, Dickens, you know. I was reading, I pushed it like after a while, you know, it's like, so he describes, you got like, you have a, like two pages that describe the door going into the captain's, room. You have a whole, you have a paragraphs for the window, and you have like, you know, and one of the paragraphs describing the crack in the window, right? So this 800-page book, you know, you take out the cliff notes, it's 30 pages long. But when you read the cliff notes, you don't get into the book. I tell you, everybody has their confessions. This is my confessions. You know, chant the wrong religion, but confession.
Talking about a galaxy.
What?
Talking about a galaxy.
Right. So I walked into a bookstore a few years ago, and I said, you know, I have a problem. I'm an over reader. Like when I get into a book, I can't put it down. Like, you know, I walked into, you know, these the two ladies with like this private, you know, bookstore. He says, "I'm starting a new thing called Overreaders Anonymous. Do you want to join?" He says, "Yeah, we're in." I mean, when I got married, you know, we found this out. You know, I got married. I picked up the book All for the Boss. I read the whole book. I mean, when I was a kid, I did this too. And I never went to sleep before finishing a book. Before 4 o'clock in the morning, I was still up reading the book. My mother used to come and like turn off the lights, and I would read with a flashlight. She'd take out a flashlight. I'd read by the streetlight. I would not go to bed until I finished the book. It'd be 600 pages long. I finished the book before I went to bed. Right? Not because I was a shita. I just couldn't put it down. Right? You can do that to the cliff notes. You can't do that to a real book. What's the difference? A real book draws you in and it connects you to the story. That's the meat of das. You get so connected to it that you feel connected. You almost can't let go of that world. Reading cliff notes doesn't have, you know, it's information. So there's a meaning which we have, which is das, which people go to watch movies. And they get all emotional about a movie. Now, it's pixels on a screen. Like, what are you getting emotional about? The power of the movie is to get you connected to the story to the point that you get emotional. Your heart's racing. Well, it's going to be. You start crying. Right? That's what we have a multi-trillion-dollar industry, which its goal is to connect you to things. That's the meat of das. So the koyach of das that allows you to do that with real knowledge takes time to develop in the human being. That's when the Torah refers to the union between a man and a woman as Vayeda Adam Mischava Ishtar. He knew her. The physical act is referred to knowing her. What does it mean the physical act referring to knowing her? What we're saying was that the Maisa of the physical act was an expression of a true understanding of each part, one of the other. I truly knew who she was to the point that I connected to her. And through that, the physical Maisa expresses that relationship. That's what the Maisa is supposed to be. It's ability for a human being to get outside of himself into something else. That's a tremendously powerful koyach. If it's used right, it's the greatest thing in the world. It's the source of all chesed. That I can truly understand you. Revolva has a fascinating piece that he has in his Vadim on Chesed. So he says the first, you know, they would work. He has a series of Vadim where he works with the Talmidim on different areas. So the first one is on Chesed. One of them is on Chesed. She says, for the first 2 weeks, we're not doing anything. First 2 weeks, I want you to do the following: go out there 3 times a day, stop and contemplate a random person that you met, what are their needs? You meet a person on the street, you don't really know them, think about what do you think he needs in life. Start to become more aware of people's needs. That's the first step of chesed. You understand people's needs, so then you start fulfilling them. Okay, this is what they were given as the job of the next 2 weeks of the Baal. They came back in 2 weeks in the report, and he records this in his sefer. He says, basically the report was, basically most people need the same things as me. He says, you know what happened? You basically reflected yourself onto everybody around you. You didn't really contemplate what they need. You saw yourself reflected in all these people. You didn't really get them. Rabbi Fran has a great story. He's talking about a context of marriage. He says, there's a couple, I guess, I'm not sure what the motivation was, you know, whether they were having problems, they weren't having problems. They did the following. They said, okay, we're going to do the following exercise. So the husband and the wife, the husband sat down and wrote down 20 things which he thought was important to his wife that she wanted in their relationship, the interface, etc. And the wife did for the husband. And then they ordered them in order of priority. Then they gave the papers to each other to grade. So the wife wrote down that number one, her husband wants supper on the table when he walks in the door. She thought that was very important to him. He graded that as number 15. He's not a guy. He doesn't really care. He has no problem waiting. But she had spent X amount of her years of marriage rushing like her kishkas out to make sure there was supper on the table, resenting the fact that he's making this demand of her, which he never made. But she was thinking that's what he wants. Right? Then they took the pages and they put it under the, they have like a coffee table with like a glass thing over there to remind themselves how much they need to learn about each other. It's an awesome exercise. But imagine that. These people are living together. They love each other. They care about each other. And they really don't understand each other. They're projecting what they think the other person wants on the other person, which a person never really said. Never really wanted. So we think we're about the chesed and we really care about other people. You know, most people like they want, you know, their kids should be healthy, the kids should be safe, the kids should be accomplished, they want, you know, they should be healthy, you know. We already have the basic needs, the same basic needs. Well, we just made an exercise and that's not true. People are different. And what's really important to me is not what's really important to you. But how am I supposed to figure that out if I only see the world through my own eyes, my own lenses? So the meat of das is to learn to really get to know you and see the world through your lenses. And that's what marriage offers a person. So what's unique about the physical expression of that, go back to page 58, please. Okay, the Rambam classifies the limbs and organs of the body into two groups. First, there are those organs that exist for the service of the person himself. He's constant page, next page. I'm sorry. Page 59, the bottom paragraph. So it goes on. Okay. So the Rambam says that the limbs and organs of the body are in two groups. Page 60. There are the organs that exist for the service of the person himself. These are the vast majority of our organs. They make the possible physical survival and supply him with whatever he needs. Second, there are those that have been given for us for the purpose of perpetuating the species. That's where the difference between male and female exists, and that through them, the continuation of the generations is ensured in the framework of marriage. In other words, for the person's own existence, there's no need to have reproductive organs. The reproductive organs are only there for, in order that there should be somebody else. So it's a physical manifestation of giving, not taking. They are the only part of the person which is made for giving. Because every part of the body is there that I should have. It's about me. I need to eat. I need to have air. I need lungs to bring in the air. I need food, mouth to take in the food. I need eyes to understand that for safety. Everything. Oh, it's all about me. The only part of my body which is not about me, it's about that there should be other generations, there should be people out there, is the reproductive organs. So those are the only part of the body which reflects the ability to not to get, to take, but to give. So, in this mita of das, which is the ability to not to see myself, but to actually understand the other person, is the physical representation of that is the reproductive organs. That's the meat of Das. So that is a very powerful thing, because it's the ability to create. So the Yisim Kelokim, right, before the Mice of the Yisim Kelokim, before the Eitz Hadas, the Mice of Bia was not need to be covered. After they ate from the Eitz Hadas, Tov V'Ra, they became very intimately connected to Tov V'Ra. The Mice of Bia became something which there can be a misuse of it. And if it has to be covered. That's the place where we need to put limits. Yeah, we need to put limits on our eating of our food. But there's a certain amount. Most people, they can't eat more than a certain amount. They get sick of it. Because it's about taking in. There's a limit to how much you can take in. But here, we're taking the kayak, which it's really made to give. It's really made to create. It's really made to be the world of giving. And we misappropriate it for our own usage to take. That is a corruption of reality. That's why it's such a problem. But if a person uses it right and he limits it, it's a very powerful ability to connect with somebody. And that is what makes us into creators. Makes us into the Rosham's mita is that he's a giver, not a taker. So what he gave away to the world was that we're going to control the world. Because we're going to become, as it were, the replacement for him. We're going to become the what Adonijah wanted was the control of the world. He wanted to be the Elohim. Versus, I'm going to give it to Avraham Avinu. Adonijah didn't get it right. Avraham Avinu, I'm going to give it to him. He's the control of the world. He's the Elohim. He gets to create the world in a certain sense. By becoming like me, becoming a giver, not a taker. Avraham Avinu was tested and tested and tested about being a giver, not a taker. So now you're ready to be the one who takes over this job. Where am I going to make an ois bris on that? Because you were able to take the part of the body which is about giving and use it for that purpose. And only over there, that's going to be the ois bris. That's where you're going to show that you have the ability to limit yourself. And the limiting yourself allows you to be Yisim Kelokim, to be a creator, as opposed to using that power, which is about creation, for yourself. Which is what Adam Rishon was faulted at. So I think that's the thought process we want to accomplish over here. So, go to page 19, please. Yes, I my math is bad. Yeah. I don't know how to count. Okay. So this is a piece from Elisher from Revolver, Chelik Aleph. But first, I want you to read the note on the bottom. Every performance of a mitzvah is an act of giving birth. Because I'll say, the Ikra told Samuel Shil Tzadikim is Maisim Tovim, right? Rashi, beginning of Parshas Noach, right? Therefore, the same fact of Das that enables the body to produce offspring also makes it possible the performance of mitzvahs in the most complete manner, so the mitzvah itself has an effect on the world and produces further fruits. We therefore see the intrinsic connection between the signs of physical maturity, which is the ability to produce offspring, and the obligation to perform mitzvahs. The true concept of a mitzvah, right? Mitzvah accomplishes the following. That's late. Okay, the Ramchal says the following. We say by the Haggadah, if the Rosh would have put birth to our Sinai and not given us a Torah, it would have been the Yenu. Now, it doesn't mean it's enough to stop there, because it's not enough to stop there. But it means each one is enough that we have to, there was something special which happened that moment, which we have a need to give thanks for. So, all of the things, yeah, I get it. And the Russian gave the Torah and not give us, well, you know what? We still have to thank him for the Torah. I get it. The Russian gave us Shabbos and not the Torah. We have to thank him for the Shabbos. What's the mile going to Har Sinai without the Torah? What happened at Har Sinai? So the Russian was Kareis Bris with Klal Yisrael. Right? The Russian made a bris with Klal Yisrael. And he said, you're going to be the Melechus Kahanim of Gai Kodesh. So you're the Melechus Kahanim. So he uses that mashal. He said like this. Imagine a non-Kayan goes into the Beit HaMikdash to do the Avodah. He loves the Kodesh Baruch. He cares so much and he wants to do the Avodah. So it's a beautiful expression of the person's love for Kodesh Baruch. What's the Lacha? The Avodah is possible. Because the non-Kayan is not imbued with the spiritual wherewithal to accomplish what a carbon is supposed to accomplish. A Kayan is imbued with that spiritual wherewithal. So when he brings a carbon, it creates what the world is, what it's, what all of the things that the carbon is supposed to bring to the world, it accomplishes. So the difference between a non-Jew and a Jew when they do a mitzvah, or the Jews before Har Sinai and the Jews after Har Sinai, is before they do the mitzvah, what they're expressing is our desire to come close to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Beautiful thing. But that the mitzvah should affect the world and change the world and have spiritual implications, we weren't empowered to that till Har Sinai. When the Russian said, you're the Melechus Kahanim, you're now the Kahanim for the world, means when we do mitzvahs, they impact all of the world in a way which could not happen beforehand. So every mitzvah that we do changes the world. We create Paris. We're giving birth. We're actually creating something with the mitzvah. The ability to create something with the mitzvah starts with our mitzvah. The smid of das, the physical representation, the fact that there's physical maturity, is a parallel. We spoke about the thing that the Russian makes a physical reality parallel to spiritual reality. Is because we've developed to a point where we're actually able to see beyond ourselves and to connect to somebody outside of ourselves. So the physical reality is an expression of the spiritual reality of what a bar mitzvah is. That he's now a bar das. Therefore, when he does mitzvahs, they create fruit. They actually accomplish something. So that's the foot on the bottom. Now let's look at the second paragraph. Or the first, one must by all means not view physical desire as something which is inherently base. It's a holy creation. Russian found no better place to stamp the mark of his covenant with us than on the flesh of the most sensitive physical organ. Okay, next paragraph. When we contemplate the process of physical maturation, we notice that the two inclinations go into the formation of a single individual. The temperament of his body cells, he belongs to himself. The cells of his body multiply at a fantastic rate from the moment of conception. They continue to do so throughout the months of gestation, onward, first 20 years of his life, building up his body. But the temperament of reproductive cells, they're there at the first moment of his life. He does not belong to himself. He bears with him the inheritance of his ancestors in both body and soul. He has DNA which he can pass on to the next generation. His responsibility to pass on to the next generation. These cells do not multiply during his earlier years. It's only when it reaches the age of a mitzvah that they begin to multiply. At the same time, the organs begin to enlarge. He matures physically. So here is a physical manifestation. You've grown to the point you're no longer living for yourself. That's what's happened. A bar mitzvah is a person who's no longer living for himself. He now has a part of his being which is about something greater than himself. That is the moment which is the physical representation of that is an expression of the spiritual growth that you're now able to connect beyond yourself. You're a bar das. So that's what Chazal say, that the next paragraph. This being so, a man must realize that from the moment of his reproductive cells begin to multiply, he's no longer living only for himself. What's taking place in a father's body, preparing him to be a father of children, the presenters of a new generation. A father is a whole new ballgame. You're responsible for something beyond yourself. You're not just living for yourself. Say it in other words. What's the difference between a person who's immature and a person who's mature? People immature think about only about themselves. People mature think about other people. We use those words like that. We use those words. Physical maturity is because now we're no longer living for ourselves. What our society has created is people which are physically mature, which are immature. They live only for themselves. And therefore, what they do is they take the part of their body which represents maturity and they use it in an immature way. That's a corruption. That's why that's a terrible thing, what you're doing over there. But he must begin preparing for the polar role of fatherhood. What that means is the idea that you control it, you're shown that you're mature enough to be a father. The ability to control this area, which is it's very tempting, is a way to prepare yourself for the living a world, but it's not about you, it's about somebody else. So the Russian says, I'm going to test you in a physical way. Can you approach the world that it's not about you? So I'm going to give you something which is very desirable and very, very enticing and very, it's seductive to see, can you, as it were, take that power of creation and giving and maturity and use it in a mature way? Then you're right to be a father. And that's the process of, there's 5 years between the Chazal say physical maturity and the time to get married. And that's why I have to tell you, I believe that the difference between when a bachur learns Gemara at the age of 15, 16, 17, it's a whole different ballgame than a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old. It's a whole different level of understanding. Because he's understanding, he's starting to really understand the Gemara, not himself. He's not putting himself into the Gemara. He's getting what the Gemara, he's connecting to the Gemara. So at the end of this thought, he says that when a person is careful with his das, he actually can connect to a piece of Gemara. He can find a piece of Gemara as fast, as enveloping as a good novel. There's the meat of das allows you to really connect to a Gemara. And I saw by Rebbe, like, you know, Rebbe Gifter, when he was learning Gemara, he was out of this world. He's not aware of time. You would ask him a kash and shir, so Pasha, like, he had to come back down to earth before he would hear you. Like, he would hear like the sound. There's somebody making a noise. He wouldn't hear what you were saying sometimes. And then he would, like, you know, Vash. Like, that's not to scare out of your mind. Right there, you know, you'd have to repeat yourself a lot of times, because, but he didn't hear you the first time. He was so absorbed, he was connected to another world. Okay. That's, I think, the understanding the process. So let's just review quickly. So the point of the Krisis Bris is giving over something of tremendous value, the most important thing to us, to others. Barashim did it by giving us the ability to decide the fate of the world, which that's the most precious thing that he has. He gave it to us, so we, in a sense, now we're saying, putting it full circle, we became the creators of the world in a certain sense. We actually create the fate of the world. So we fulfilled Adam's dream of Yisim Kelokim. That's what Rav Avinu did by becoming a giver and not focusing on himself. He was able to do what Abraham was. He was able to represent the Kodesh Baruch Hu. We do that through the process of limiting. The limiting is, it's not a, and the, now we understand the limits is to put, take me out of the picture, end me, I'm going to end and become complete in the ability to be a giver. That's represented if in the physical organ, which is about giving, not about taking. It's the only organ in the body which is made about giving, not about taking. We are tremendously challenged in that area, because that is where the greatest opportunity for growth being a giver is, and the greatest ability of connecting is made through there, of actually connecting and understanding somebody else with the meat of das, which is truly to get somebody else and understand them, which makes you the greatest giver which is possible. The ability to abuse it is what Adam Rishon accomplished by eating from the Eitz HaDas. He abused the Das. And when we learn to use that in a mature way, we become truly spiritually and emotionally mature, parallel to our physical maturity, to become givers as opposed to takers. That's the basic idea. Okay.